Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Would You Date a Scientist? I am your host, Wendy Gannon, and I am joined this week by Mark Stevenson from Dazon Group. He is the head of applied data science there, and I'm really looking forward to this chat. Hi, Mark. How are you doing?
Hello, Wendy. I'm well, thank you. Honoured to be here. How are you?
I'm good. The sun is shining. I've just got back from walking the dog in the park, and
That's a more productive morning than I've had. Looking at the sun from inside.
Oh, bless you. Look, I hope this weather stays because I'm not going to lie, my heating bill has been ridiculous. I'm sure everyone else has as well. I'd like to ask a second time, actually, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good. It's been an exciting start to the year at DAZN and for me personally. Very glad we just had a long weekend. So we're recording this just after the Easter weekend. Yep. So four days off allowed me to catch up on sleep. But yeah, it's been a great start to the year and some holidays planned work well. So yeah, I'm really, really good at the moment. Thank you.
Good. I like that. So talking of the bank holiday, I think this is the first time in about 15 years that I slept and ate chocolate. That's pretty much all I did.
I wish I could say that was the first time in 15 years I'd also done that. That would be a bit of a lie.
Oh, bless you. So let's get cracking then. What is your favourite piece of tech ever?
Oh, favourite piece of tech ever. No, it's probably a common answer, but I might have to go for the phone.
Sure. Are you an Android or an Apple?
Oh, I'm Apple have got me around their finger. I'm full on Apple, iPad, AirPods, iPhone, MacBooks. I'm afraid I'm a typical person. I couldn't live without my phone. But there's certain stuff in it that just still amazed me, like the Face ID.
Yeah.
Like when I was growing up in the 90s, that was still sci-fi. And now every time I want to pay, I use Face ID. And I still adore that. So it would be my iPhone.
You don't even have to do that now. Your watch connects and it automatically, if you've got your watch on, it automatically does the face. Oh, yeah, it's bizarre.
I think the Apple Watch is the one bit of Apple products I haven't yet got. It's missed my last holdout.
It saved me, genuinely, because I, during the first lockdown, I was not well. I couldn't get out of bed for ages and I put on so much weight and it's helped me to definitely get my health back up. So thanks, Apple. that is a good answer. Get the watch. But I should get beyond commission or something, yeah. So how did you get into data science? Can you talk me through your journey?
Yeah, absolutely. So looking back for when I was at school, I think if you could design a job that was for me, it would be data science, looking back in hindsight. I didn't necessarily know that when I left uni and entered the job market. But I started off my career in consulting, but doing kind of analytics. And at university, I'd done economics, but I basically picked all my subjects on the basis of which involved the least writing and essays and which involved doing the most maths and statistics. So I'd done like a very mathematical statistical degree. So for me, I think once data science grew from like a nascent industry to be much more popular is nowadays, it was kind of inevitable that I'd end up in there. About 4 years ago, I finally got the job title data scientist and have been in data science ever since then. But yeah, like throughout my career, throughout university, I've always been doing statistics, always been doing applied maths. So it's maybe been a little bit of a more linear journey than most. For the entirety of my career, I didn't have the title data scientist, which I think for a lot of people that was the case. I think only now really you've got, or maybe in the last 2 or 3 years, you've had entry roles data science in a lot of companies, which allow people to be data scientists from day one.
Definitely. So you were at PwC before that, weren't you? Did you do a master's?
I didn't, no. So I just did bachelor's. So no master's, nothing else for me, which I think is uncommon nowadays.
So one of my questions that I ask every time is, do you think it's important for people to have a master's degree? Because as a recruiter, a lot of the time that's on the job spec. To have a numerate or statistical master's degree, and I don't think that that's fair, because we've got to be inclusive of different socioeconomic backgrounds, etc. I can't afford to go to uni, so
I totally agree, 100% agree. I don't like seeing requires a PhD or requires a master's on a job spec. There is probably a small subset of roles where they are helpful. You know, if you're deep, you know, machine learning research, maybe the big tech companies, and that's absolutely fine. And very glad that there's people interested in, you know, skilled enough that can do that. But I think for the vast majority of data science roles, and especially the data science I focus on, the applied data science, having business impact and the commercial roles, you don't need a master's or a PhD in my opinion. There's a lot to be gained from like your problem solving, how you can interact in business, and more so than kind of the formal learnings that a master's would give you. Of course, I think if you're lucky enough to do a master's and want to do it, you should pursue it.
Oh, absolutely,
but I just don't think it's needed.
Yeah, absolutely. So as a hiring manager, what do you look for in a data scientist?
So I think problem solving is probably how I'd most succinctly say it. And I think at the heart of it, data scientists are definitely problem solvers. Whether that's a statistical problem or a coding problem. So do they have the aptitude to kind of and the persistence to continue to solve problems, to match it to the business needs, to show that they've got impact? Obviously, there's some kind of baseline health warning for the level you're looking to hire at. You know, do they have a suitable level of coding knowledge? Do they know the basics of statistics, for example? But you can, especially at the entry level, you can teach people to code better. You can teach people syntax and coding concepts. I think it's harder to teach the aptitude of problem solving and having creativity within data science. So definitely the creativity in problem solving is number one. Number two would be around communication, being in a team, being a collaborator.
Yep.
And I think that's probably a big thing for a lot of people, especially coming into data science, maybe coming into their first programming job if they're not coming from an engineering background, is moving from being a sole programmer where you write everything yourself to being part of a team that's going to contribute to a bit of analysis or contribute to a model or contribute to a pipeline. And that's something which is a big change to do, because all of a sudden you're changing from, are you writing code, are you doing analysis that works, to are you doing analysis and writing code that other people can not only understand but contribute to. So that's kind of a bit of like the technical teamwork skills, but also the soft teamwork skills in terms of collaboration. So those are two things which are like absolutely critical. Maybe if we have some more specific roles, sometimes we'd look for maybe people with maybe certain more flavor in terms of Bayesian statistics or frequentist or that, but that's kind of around the edges. The core of what we look for doesn't change.
Perfect. What do you actually do at Desmond Group?
So I lead a great team that's kind of globally spread, which builds data science and machine learning models, which hopefully improve business outcomes. So we're a subscription business, so you can guess some of the stuff we do. We build models which predict who's going to cancel at the end of their month and try and get them to stay. We show live sports, so we predict how many people are going to watch fixtures. And we do this with a system of models, and then we try and integrate them into bits of software and systems that other people in the business can use. For those people that maybe aren't fully immersed in data science, a common way to classify data scientists is type A, i.e. analysis data scientists, and type B, building data scientists. It's probably a fascinating discussion about which companies need the most and at what part of their life cycle need the most. And we certainly do a bit of both, but the team I lead focuses on the type B, the building, so the building of the machine learning models.
Perfect. So this podcast, as you know, Mark, is aimed at people who are wanting to get into data science, either through pivoting from a role that they're already in or through academia. What advice would you give those people, and how can they get their first position?
I think the first thing I would say is just start. And we're fortunate to be up in the data science industry that there's loads of courses, loads of books, loads of tutorials, loads of websites, either for free or very low cost. And the barriers to entry to getting into the industry have reduced, or certainly barriers to entry to knowing what the industry is about has reduced. And I think if you're pivoting, just start by doing something. You know, have a portfolio, try some analysis projects on the side, One of the very first things I did many years ago when I was like teens, early 20s, was I was doing some analysis on football matches, just because I enjoyed it, big football fan. Build a
Who
portfolio, Leeds.
Okay.
So always sees if you stop smiling when I say Leeds. But yeah, just try different things. Build your portfolio. It's going to do two things. It's going to be a signal to people that you're interested in the subject, that you've got a skill set, that you've got an aptitude for it. But also it allows you to find the niche that you want. At the moment, data science is ridiculously wide, and it's got a lot of industries that used to be standalone, like applied statisticians, predictive analytics, things like that, that are now under the umbrella of data science.
Yep.
And you're not going to necessarily know where you want to sit under data science unless you try different things and find your niche. So start is number one. There is options such as coding boot camps or data science boot camps. I haven't done one of those personally.
Okay.
I think they're right for some people. They're not right for other people.
Yep.
I think some people are good to go down the applied route. Other people prefer that education route. And then I think data science, you can easily start as a data analyst, say, and progress into data science. Or you can start as maybe a strategy analyst and progress into data science. So you don't have to make that leap in one big go. I think if you do try and make that leap in one big go, and this is definitely targeted more towards people from an existing role, realistically, you probably would have to be reasonable about your promotion and pay rise and pay level ambitions. Even though you've got, you know, maybe 8-10 years of experience, which is definitely valid, especially on the business side, especially on the communication side, and we shouldn't undervalue that in any way. You may need to accept that you're starting at a maybe slightly lower pay level to get your foot in the door.
100%.
Getting your foot in the door is absolutely fine in data science. I'm wary of making predictions, given I've built predictive models for a living. I know how hard it is. But my prediction is that, you know, for the next 10, 20 years, machine learning data science industry is going to be growing. Getting the foot in the door now, getting started, even if you have to take maybe a slight pay cut or what may be perceived as a backward step, is going to pay off in 2, 3, 4 years pretty easily.
I entirely agree with that. You can't expect somebody to take you on not knowing the role at the same pay level as you're on. I know it's not necessarily great, but if that's something that you want to get into, it's a hit that you're going to have to take. Go on.
If you want to get into data science for the right reasons, because it's fair to say it's a hyped market, everyone loves the buzzwords AI and ML, but if you want to get into the right reasons, that's a really easy trade-off to make. Because if you know you want to do it for life, you know you enjoy it, then any short-term hit to, you know, be it your title perception or your pay, will pay off through A, enjoyment, but B, in the long term, you're going to get the pay anyway.
Yeah, I mean, happiness is, it's a good trade-off just for your happiness, isn't it?
Agreed.
So what about people coming through academia? There's a lot, and I am asking this question because I know the answer. there's a lot of people who are struggling to find jobs at entry level.
Yeah.
So how can those people find a role?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's a similar sort of answer in terms of build the portfolio, get started, show people what you can do. I think at a certain point, people come to value what you can do in your experience more than your qualifications. And so if you can show people what you can do, contribute to open source, blog about it, create a GitHub pages site, there's a whole wealth of options where when you're a hiring manager, or you're just interested in the industry, you can see what people are interested in, which is another signal, and a different signal to if you've come from university. I would also try and like immerse yourself in the data science industry. So speak to people, message people. Anyone listening to this, welcome to message me on LinkedIn. You know, when I was looking to do it, I did that. I reached out to my network, reach out to companies. Join conferences. There's a lot of conferences or talks, again, which are free and low cost. Try and immerse yourself in the world and understand, okay, what is the skill set that hiring managers are looking for? What's the skill set that companies are looking for? because I can almost guarantee, regardless of your background, whether you are a pure computer scientist, whether you are a applied mathematician, whether you're an economist like me, whether you've done marketing analytics, whether you're a biostatistician, and I could go on and on and on,
yeah.
I guarantee there is a suitable role out there for you, because data science is such a multidisciplinary field. You've just got to kind of do the searching to find the, meet the person, meet the recruiter, meet the company that has a role or roles that are suitable for you.
Perfect. I'm the recruiter. Everybody come and talk to me. So you take on entry-level people, don't you?
We do. Yes.
Can you talk me through that process?
Yeah. So we as a company and as a team, I'd say, are very passionate about giving entry-level people a chance and giving them the first role, because I think that can be really hard for some people, because you just don't know what to expect. You don't necessarily 100%. Know how to interview that. And it's easy to say, me sitting here with 8 years of experience, and but until someone's shown you, so you've had that first experience, it can be a whole daunting thing. What is the world of work like, especially from people that come from maybe, you know, so lower socioeconomic backgrounds, that maybe their parents or their family members haven't shall we say, a service, an office job before. So we try and make our processes as accessible as possible and as inclusive as possible. We actually put our job spec through a gendered language tool, which there's loads of those on the internet.
Yep.
And though we thought we'd done a pretty good job, that opened up our eyes to a couple of areas where we hadn't done a good enough job. But I would say to any hiring managers, try and make it as inclusive as possible, because the talent pool is wider than you think.
Yes.
I mean, I think for a lot of ML departments, a lot of tech companies like ourselves, you know, we would be lying if we said we had it solved, because we don't. And you can see that by the makeup of the staff. We don't have it solved. There's more to do. But I think if you can try and make a difference with every single hire you do, and especially the entry-level hires, over time, that difference is going to accumulate up. We then try and interview as background blind or as academic and school blind as possible.
Yep.
My personal opinion is that we should be pretty school blind in all hiring. I know some of the big four consultancies have started doing this.
Yep.
And so you can't necessarily sell the university you go to, and big fan of that. And so once we try and make that top of the funnel as wide as possible and as inclusive as possible, then our process is relatively simple. We do have a tech test. Our tech test is designed to be less about, do you get it right or wrong, and much more about, what is your thinking? Because again, people from different backgrounds will have different approaches, which we value. And so our approach is we get people to submit a tech test. The actual answer doesn't matter anywhere near as much as, can you talk through what you've done? Can you have a conversation? And then after that, we've also got a stage where you'll probably be speaking with me and a couple of my colleagues about your background, a few questions, how you'd approach problem solving, how you'd work in a team, also to understand your interests. So I'm not a fan of, shall we say, the big tech hiring process of, you know, do this. Can you invert a binary tree on a whiteboard? Probably because I probably couldn't.
Yeah. Maybe I'm biased. Especially under that pressure, right?
Exactly. But I would rather interview in a way that is as close to what the skills you'd need in the actual job anyway. We try and give full information in our process. We'll say, you'll speak to these people, we'll cover these sort of things, and you've got a tech test, and we recommend it. You know, it'll take 2 or 3 hours prep, won't do any more on that, and you'll need to talk through it and present it how you want, a .R file, a Markdown file, a PowerPoint, a Jupyter notebook. Try and make the candidate as comfortable as possible so they can show the skills, what they've got. Don't try and interview for, we don't try and interview for a clone of ourselves. That's bad for a whole host of reasons.
Oh, this is so refreshing to hear.
Subconsciously, we all do it. And we've all got through it. Subconsciously, we all do kind of look for similarities. So I think you have to really try to do the opposite to avoid those subconsciouses sneaking in.
Yeah. Oh, it's so nice to hear. So you've got very much the approach that I have when I'm hiring. So completely agree with the gender wording. I mean, I talk about this a lot throughout the podcast, because women will turn away from masculine words, but men or those who identify as won't turn away from feminine, more feminine words. So yeah, that's great that you're doing that. When I was hiring for myself, I literally gave everybody that got interviewed the questions that I was going to ask them at interview, because like, as you say, people, they just might not know. Somebody might have moved to this country and has no idea how our interview processes work, etc. And you just need to give everybody the same chance.
Yeah.
And it's really nice to hear that. Thank you, Mark, for doing that.
It's also in data science, you could be asked questions about how you set up an experiment, or you could ask me questions about how you solve a SQL problem, or you could ask me questions about how you set up a linear regression and what are the assumptions of linear regression. Like the range of questions is so crazy wide.
Yeah.
I think it's unfair if you ask a subset of questions that might be someone's weaknesses when they have massive strengths elsewhere. So often, you know, we just ask, talk us through a project you're really proud of. And then if there's we always do panel interviews. So ideally three, occasionally we've had to do two, but ideally three people, which again helps rather than just one individual. We know if we ask a broad question, someone can talk through their experience and I'll talk through a project. The three of us there probably have enough knowledge, cumulative over 20 years in the industry, to answer and have a conversation with them. And then if they've picked something where they've used natural language processing or decision trees or whatever it is, we know a bit to have a conversation about it rather than us going, derive the OLS equation for me in linear regression or whatever. someone just doesn't know that. So me an interview is much more conversation. Make the person comfortable. Yeah. Let them tell us where their skill set and their strengths lie.
Yeah. I think it's also important to ask after the interview how they found it so that you can improve your interview process. And like just honest feedback. Were you comfortable? Is there anything that we could change to make a better experience for you? I think all of those things are really important.
Yeah.
Also, I'm just going to pick up that you said that what are your likes, what are your hobbies? So like, that's really very important. A lot of people don't think that's important for their CV or anything. It really is. I mean, if you think about it, we're all about building relationships and finding common ground, right? If you've got something on your CV or resume that your interviewer does, then you've straight away got something in common and you've got something to talk about, you know? It is really important. And they can see what kind of person you are from what you do outside of work as well.
Yeah. And I think skilled interviewers will be able to have a conversation with pretty much anything, even if the hobbies are slightly different. But it's still you, as you said, if you talk for long enough, you'll find common ground with absolutely anyone. One of the questions we're asked a lot is, do you have to be a sports fan to join DAZN? And the answer, of course, is no. But we do tell people a lot of people in the company are mad sports fans.
Yeah,
but you don't have to be. But if you're interested in something else, a company, where thousands of people, we're global, we're all over the world. There's definitely a group or a team of people that are also interested in that when you join, you can share your interest with. So I think allowing your personality to come to the fore as early on in the interview process, and then when you join, is mutually beneficial for everyone.
I'm just thinking back as you're saying that to when I was younger and interviewing, and I definitely didn't show my personality to anyone. Like, it's like you have to be a robot, and it just doesn't work, does it? I think I hid my personality for so long, and aren't you all lucky that I stopped doing that? So what is your team set up, out of interest?
Yeah, so we have as I said, we're global, so we're fortunate we have people based on four continents, which is an absolute pleasure to work with. And I would say I've been fortunate enough, not by design, but by accident, to work in teams and companies where that's always been the case. And I'd now recommend to anyone, if you get the opportunity to work in a global team, definitely do. Your perspectives are increased. The conversation is just much more varied. And then also you've got friends all around the world if ever you're in a country. We at DAZN, we have two paths for kind of people to progress, what we call the individual contributor path and the people manager path. This is common in the industry. We're definitely in the majority bucket by having that common. And then we have like people on the data science level, senior data scientists and lead data scientists this level. But we work in completely cross-functional teams, which I think is really important. But so on any given project, you could be with a lead or a senior, then there's almost certainly people from the business that might be an engineer. It might be someone from DevOps. It might be someone from a data analyst from a different part of the team. And that's because data science is really, really, it really has value when it's in context. And I'll give a really trivial example to explain what I mean by that. I'm not giving much away by saying the most watched fixtures in the Premier League are Liverpool, Man United, Man City, Chelsea. And if you came to the Zone and did some data analysis and presented that as an insight, it's going to say that's trivial. Whereas if you have knowledge of the football market and go, that's really common, everyone knows, that's been the trends for 20 years, you'll know that that's trivial. So if I'm giving a simple example of this podcast, it's the same with much more things internally, where you need the context of the people in operations or the people in finance or the people in engineering or the people that broadcast our sport. So all of our projects are designed to have business impact, and we work cross-functionally. So our team setup, while being pure data science, is different to our project setup, which involves a whole array of stakeholders every single day of the week. We have a number of people that kind of focus on getting the minimum viable product out. So obviously that's terminology we've borrowed from the products world. We often call it minimum viable model. So a minimum viable model. So can you get a model out in a few days, get a baseline, what works, what doesn't, do some analysis, which is, I think, what a lot of people think of data science, like, is there a correlation between two variables? If I plot something X and Y, do I see a straight line or do I see maybe a log line? What's the distribution of the variables? You know, is it everything centered around a single value, or is it really spread out? So we've got a number of people who do that. And then once we've got like a minimum viable model in place, we have a group of people who then what we call putting that model into production. And for those that don't know what that means, that basically means that people can rely on the model. It's scoring or making predictions regularly. If it needs to be integrated in software, someone else in the business will click on a button and they'll see it on their computer. We make sure that all the controls are around it, that it's coded to a high enough quality that it's going to be there. So we've really got people focusing on kind of that type A analysis and people focusing on the type B building. But our type A analysis is all to inform our type B building.
Brilliant, brilliant. Let's talk about ethics. A little bit. So I know you've got some quite strong views on this, which is wonderful. Mm-hmm. So talk to me about your views.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think I definitely think as an industry, we have the ability to do good for the world. Now, I guess do good for the world in itself is a simple thing to say and a hard thing to define, because everyone's got kind of different opinions on that. But I do think there's a number of data science roles, which, you know, maybe in the health industry in particular, but other industries as well, that are using data science as a force for good, putting information in people's hands. And I think that's a really positive use of data science. I think there's definitely been historic cases, and maybe I'll just say Cambridge Analytica, and won't go any more different about that, where maybe it hasn't quite been as good case. And it comes back to the point we were talking about earlier in terms of hiring and having the funnel as wide as possible. I think if you have the funnel as wide as possible and you have as diverse and different perspectives, especially on your team, you collectively come to more like what is good for the world. And so I think there's, in the next few years, I think ensuring that data science is used as a force for good, and maybe beyond the most used use case at the moment, which is probably targeting personalized ads.
Yeah.
And as an aside, I'm definitely not saying personalized ads are a bad thing. There's a strong argument to be made there that personalized ads could actually allow free products to make money. Those free products are available to the world. So again, it's a trade-off that everyone considers something good. Some of people may consider that bad.
I
definitely think there's scope to use data science in a whole variety of ways.
Absolutely agree. The only reason I love targeted advertising for me is because I see things when I'm scrolling, I'm like, oh my God, they're so amazing. And I'll just buy it. I'm awful.
They've got you in.
They've definitely got me in, just like Apple have got you. So what do you see the future of data science? I know, let's make the world a better place, 100%. And I know you said that was difficult to like specifically say, how are we going to do good? Yeah. But I think we can 100% say we can use it for not doing bad.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Harking back to the Google motto of the early noughties about don't be evil. I think, yeah, it's sometimes easier to define that than it is to define the good. Yeah,
definitely. So, yeah, what do you think? I used to say, what do you think data science is going to look like in 10 years? Then I put it down to 5, and now I just say the future. So what do you think it's going to look like?
So I think, number one, the industry is going to continue to grow and expand. And I think the you probably see it as a recruiter yourself, I see it as a hiring manager, the demand for data scientists and machine learning engineers from companies is outstripping the supply. And I don't see that changing anytime soon. I think we're going to lean more and more towards people building, let's call them ML models and ML systems.
Yep.
So people more on the building side than the analysis side. An example we're probably all familiar there is COVID recently. And anyone who's followed the Financial Times, they had so many graphs and charts on COVID and the infection rates and vaccination rates.
The science,
exactly. And that's the building of a tool that allows people to consume analysis and not having to do analysis together. I see the building of tools and software and machine learning models just increasing and increasing and increasing.
Yeah.
And a lot of those are going to be built what we consider AI. So there's recently been a tool released by OpenAI called DALL-E 2, which is where you type in some words and then images are generated for you. And it's I think there's an open version of the original DALL-E, that's DALLE. And if you haven't used it, definitely go on the internet and have a look at it. You can type an avocado chair, for example, and it will give you an image of a chair in the shape of an avocado, and it's absolutely fantastic.
Brilliant. So we'll link that in the show notes for everyone to have a play.
It's absolutely, anything by OpenAI is definitely worth keeping eye on. And I think more and more building of AI ML systems is going to happen in the future. I think that's going to have two impacts on the industry. I think there's going to be more and more engineering focus in data science, because 100%. I think there's the barrier for people to building a regression model has just reduced over and over time. You used to have to code it up yourself many, many years ago. Now you just go to a package, you know, you go to sklearn, you import linear regression, you can do it very quickly yourself. What differentiates people doing that well is how it's used, and partially how that's used is by what systems and software business processes is it integrated into. I think a lot of people have vision that AI, and especially AGI, is just going to render humans obsolete. And well, maybe in 80 years, who knows? But I think in the short term, in the 5-10 year time frame you spoke about, it's much more about improving current human processes or augmenting human processes in many ways. And so I think a continuation of the trends we currently see around engineering quality, actually deploying machine learning is definitely going to continue in the future. There's going to be more and more business models, which I think you could reduce that entire business model down to machine learning or algorithms. So I guess you could say quantitative hedge funds have been doing this for years, and I don't know much about quantitative hedge funds, but
I wish I did.
Exactly. We'd probably be on a beach in the Caribbean if we did. But you can easily see how the quality of their models and algorithms and the accuracy of their models directly reduces down to how much cash they get. Like the business model is entirely built around that algorithm, that model. But there's a number of other companies, you know, aggregators, travel sites, recommendation algorithms, where you can get the actual model is in its sense a business model, and the quality of your data science, the quality of your machine learning is directly impacted to how successful the business is, how much profit, how much money it's making. And so I think more and more businesses are going to evolve with that. That ML is like a fundamental core to the business. And I think how does that impact people looking to get into data science? As say, pure data science, pure MLE roles, the demand for those is going to be high, certainly for the next 10 years. But there's quite a lot of supporting roles around those, like maybe product managers and program managers. Or maybe you don't want to be in the depths of the coding. Maybe you want to take it to the business much more. All of those roles are going to be absolutely, absolutely vital. But what connects them all together is imagination. And I think that's still one thing which ML, AI probably can't do, which is absolutely, truly, genuine imagination. So I said earlier on in the podcast that problem solving and creativity are a couple of skills that I look for when hiring. Those skills are not going to get less important. If anything, I think they're going to get more important because actually the teaching people the syntax, the teaching people the code, getting people to use a regression has never been easier. There's whole tools, more people have done it. It's the problem solving, the imagination, the creativity. How can you use machine learning or data science for a purpose or to build a business around it is where I think you'll still need those skills to get an advantage.
Oh, love that. It's when I was at school, it was like you're either creative or you are clever. But it's definitely not the case. And it's definitely the case that we're bringing them together, like the technical skills and the communication skills and the imagination skills, as you said, and being creative, all are really, really important. And look, not everybody's got all of those skills, and that's absolutely fine. It just means that specific role is not for you. And if you want to talk through with me, and like if you want to contact me, I can definitely talk you through what roles would be best for you. I'm more than happy to do that.
I mean, certainly when I was in school, like you, there was a misnomer that if you were mathematical, you weren't creative. And with every year that I get older, I realize I don't think that's true, 100% not true. Some of the most creative people are some of the most logical people I've met. Yeah. But also that as you said, like you are either clever or creative. Again, I'm learning just a million different types of clever. It's not clever as kind of defined by school and exams and academia. And as you said, if you don't necessarily have those skills, it doesn't matter, because any large company, any small company, any open source project is a team.
Yep.
And a team matters what the team skills have got, not what an individual has. We're a sport company, so we endlessly use sports analogies. So I'm going to use a cliche sports analogy now.
Go for it.
But if you're building a football team, you may have the best defender in the world, but you don't want the best defender 11 times. You still need the midfielder and the striker.
Exactly. That's a really good analogy, and I'm going to steal that from you. I usually just say, look, it's a circle, like Trivial Pursuit pieces. Yeah. And like, you can't have two blues in there. So you need a blue, a pink, and a yellow. So otherwise, you're just not going to be able to do a full circle of jobs. You're not going to get the whole thing done. Yeah. That football analogy is much better than my Trivial Pursuit pie cheese analogy.
I definitely stole it off someone from the zone. So I'll give credit to someone internally for that.
So, right, here we are at the bonkers question of...
Yes.
There's billionaires in the world that I don't think should be there. Let's share the money with me and everyone else. Do you think that they could potentially build an evil supervillain? And if they could, how will we stop them? And what punishment should they have?
So I would hope they couldn't. And I guess I would use the word hope because we don't know for certain. But let's say there's a supervillain, an AI supervillain.
Yep.
In reality, they are going to have to get a team of engineers, of data scientists to build it. And I'd like to believe in the goodness of people, and that those people wouldn't build it, or certainly wouldn't want to build it deliberately for nefarious means.
Yeah.
There's a question about, is it then used by others for nefarious means? In which case, I would hope that someone else would be building, almost in an adversarial manner, something which prevents that, which you often see people.
Yeah. I mean,
let's say you don't like adverts on the internet. Some people have built systems to do the targeted ads, and a whole other group of engineers have built ad blocking software.
Okay, yeah.
And I think that could be one outcome. But I think let's say they did manage to get through and build the AI supervillain. I think it would probably be defeated by something very simple, such as like an integer overflow or a missing comma or a bad data type, something absolutely boring, but somewhere in the code base, something went wrong.
A wrong digit in pi.
Exactly. Just if you've ever seen War of the Worlds, and yes, where obviously these aliens come to the planet and they end up being killed by Earth bacteria, like watching it as a movie is like, oh, that's a bit dull. I wish like they were blown to pieces, but it probably is the most realistic thing that would happen to them. And I think it's similar with if someone had a super AGI, there would be an error or a bug somewhere in it, which would be a weakness.
I just watched Peacemaker. Have you seen it?
I haven't, no.
God, it's so good. Please watch it. I'm not going to give anything away. But that reminded me of Peacemaker. Everybody go and watch it. It's hilarious. Okay, thank you so much, Mark. Is there anything before we leave that you would like to plug?
Not really. I guess anyone who wants to reach out is interested in getting into data science, I'm on LinkedIn. You can also find my contact details on the website. We can probably put those in the information below, but it's markrstevenson.com. If anyone has any questions or wants to build a network in data science, please just reach out to me.
Oh, thank you so much. It was like genuinely really, really great, great conversation. I learned a lot, and I'm really, really happy that you are doing things ethically and doing it the right way. That hitting my heart there.
we're trying. I'm sure we're not perfect, but I think no one's perfect. But if people try, that's exactly.
We've all got our biases. We're always going to have our biases. It's just realizing that and making changes. Mark, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.